Let me tell you for just a little bit about the Zen school that I'm a part of and that Ten Directions Zen Center is a part of. We are part of the International Kwan Um School of Zen. The Kwan Um School of Zen was founded by Zen Master Sung San, who was one of the first Korean Zen masters to live and teach in the West. And he came to Rhode Island, I think it was in 1972 or so. And, no, I'm sorry, I think it was 1974. He moved into the Providence area. Didn't really speak English. Found a job fixing washing machines at a laundromat. But soon students discovered him. And he opened the Providence Zen Center, which at that time was in Providence, Rhode Island, moved out to Cumberland, Rhode Island at some point after. Have any of you heard of Zen Master Sung San?
Yes.
I would hope some of you have. he was an incredibly charismatic and enormous amounts of energy. And so it wasn't long before he had founded Zen centers all over the world. There are many, many Zen centers he has on really throughout the world. And so before too long, he developed the Kwan Um School of Zen as a way of trying to give some cohesion and support to that growing school of Zen centers. And that was in 1983. The Kwan Um School of Zen was founded. Kwan Um, the words themselves, translate as perceive world sound. Okay? Perceive world sound. Kwan Seum Bosal is the Korean name for the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokitesvara. Or Canon in Japanese, Kuan Yin in Chinese. So Kwan Seum Bosal in Korean. And so the Kwan Um means perceive world sound. You know, if we listen closely, we hear the sounds of the world, and what we hear is a lot of suffering. And so can we hear the sounds of a suffering world and respond with compassion appropriate to that moment? Always changing. No cookbook, no formula. Can we moment by moment by moment see clearly, perceive suffering, and respond with compassion appropriate to the moment? That's our job. That's our job as human beings. So the Kwan Um School of Zen. Let me offer a couple of just preliminary notes before I get going more on the topic. First, the title, the very title itself, Common Ground, Christian and Buddhist Contemplative Practices for Compassionate Living. Those terms, Christian and Buddhist, as you know, those are very big umbrella terms, very large umbrellas. Both of those are very large umbrellas. You know, just think in broad brushstrokes still within the Christian tradition, you've got Roman Catholics, the Protestant tradition, the Orthodox traditions. Within those, great diversity. Just think of the numbers of different Protestant denominations, Protestant churches and whatnot. So that's a huge umbrella. In a similar way, Buddhism, that's a big umbrella. You know, we've got Mahayana Buddhists and Theravadan Buddhists, Tibetan Buddhists, Pure Land Buddhists, on and on, you know, on and on. So, big umbrellas, both of them. And so depending on where someone has been standing under either of those umbrellas, if they have been, but if someone considers themselves a Christian, or considers themselves Buddhist, what I'll share tonight may seem either very familiar to them or might seem very foreign to them. And hopefully that'll make some sense by the time I'm done. So what that means is I'm not here speaking. I don't pretend to be speaking for all Christians or all Buddhists. Okay? So let me offer a kind of a second proviso at the start here. When I went onto the Theosophical Society website and was looking at different pages on it and looking at webcasts of many of the Thursday evening programs, I noticed how many of the speakers have doctorates, published books, whatnot, and became a bit self-conscious. I am grateful for the good education that I have had, but I don't pretend for a moment to be a scholar. This is not intended to be a scholarly presentation, and you'll see clearly that it's not. So what I hope that this will be thoughtful reflections based on my lived experience in contemplative spirituality and limited experience in contemplative spirituality, as all of us are. I've been at it some 36 years, and on a cosmic scheme, that's nothing. So it's coming. I'm speaking out of the experiences that I have had, and those experiences have been in a various different Catholic, Christian, and Zen Buddhist communities and groups in this country. And over those 36 odd years, I've been struck by the similarities. Very, very interesting similarities in the practices of those different contemplative practices. So we're going to share about that tonight. Okay. I'll share some thoughts for a while, and then we'll have time for questions and answers and conversation. And also, I don't want to misrepresent in any way. My background was in both Christian and Buddhist or Zen practice, but it has been predominantly in Zen practice for a good number of years now. I don't want to mislead as if I'm currently still practicing in both traditions. Let me give, I'll give a little bit of resume almost and set the stage a little with that of that background. So I was raised Roman Catholic and went to Yale Divinity School. A little bit, I'll share a bit more about that. But was raised Catholic, went to Yale Divinity School, and that's where I kind of got my start in contemplative spirituality. Not in the academic program I was studying, I assure you, but it was my good fortune that my third year there was a Trappist monk from a community in Oregon, Our Lady of Guadalupe Trappist Abbey in Lafayette, Oregon, and Peter McCarthy was his name. And Peter was out for some additional years of study, and he and I became good friends real fast. And he introduced me to contemplative spirituality, contemplative practice, and taught me and really gave me a very solid foundation for my start, which I was very grateful for. After graduation, maybe no surprise, the friendship we had and how impressed I was with the life that he was describing, I went to Oregon and tried on for size being a monk at Guadalupe Abbey for a while. short while. Sure, and interesting, in that tradition, it's 7 full years before someone can become fully professed as a monk. So it's a somewhat lengthy and rigorous screening process, so to speak, that's used, and that's a good thing. I was barely getting my feet wet, but it was a wonderful experience. And it was there that I took part in the first Zen retreats that I took part in. The abbot at that time, Bernard McVeigh, just a wonderful, maybe the most important teacher in my life, incredibly awake person. He and Peter and others in the Abbey were working very, very hard to really reclaim and clarify the Christian contemplative tradition that I wish we had more time to talk about. That's a fascinating story of how, for the last 400 years or so, how that tradition was at risk of being lost. And they were working really hard to reclaim their roots and reclaim that tradition. We're doing some interesting interfaith Zen Christian dialogue stuff. And so with a number of the monks, we attended Zen retreats led by teachers of the Sambo Kyoden tradition that were held in the Pacific Northwest. Robert Aiken Roshi, Willigis Yeager, and Joan Rick. Willigis and Joan were of interest because Willigis is a Benedictine monk priest in Germany. Joan had been a Catholic nun, I forget which order she had been in. Both had studied with Yamada Roshi in Japan. So that kind of Zen Christian dialogue was a part of my experience in contemplative practice right from the start for me. After I returned to Maine, I got involved with an organization called Contemplative Outreach. That's an organization founded by and run by Abbot Thomas Keating, a Trappist monk, had been the abbot of St. Joseph's Abbey in Spencer, Massachusetts, had moved out to Snowmass, Colorado. And he too was very heavily involved trying to reclaim the Christian contemplative tradition, make that more accessible, make it more accessible to lay people, and had started this organization called Contemplative Outreach, and I became involved with them for some time. And also then, overlapping with that, my involvement with the Kwannon School of Zen. And as John was mentioning, I've been involved with them for over 30 years now, and was authorized to teach in 2014. So enough of that. Enough of me. Let's explore some of the common ground. The first point that I would like to start with is really one that is broader than Christianity and Buddhism. I think that the starting common ground is common ground for all human beings. Yeah. It seems like perhaps what's defining of the human being is that we tend to ask these big questions. You know, what am I? What are we? Why are we here? What's the purpose of our being here? Where did we come from? What is God? What's our relationship to God? These huge, big questions. Human beings seem to do that. No matter what background, we seem to do that. maybe back to the dawn of humanity, or maybe invert that. You know, maybe that's what made the human being the human being, when they started doing that. I don't know. Historians suggest that going on 3,000 years ago, or 2,800 years ago or so, there was this just remarkable evolution in human consciousness. Just an explosion, a remarkable time of development in human consciousness and the advent of self-consciousness. And for a period of 800 years or so, remarkable to think that it's during that time frame that Confucianism and Taoism got going in East Asia. It was the development of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism in South Asia. Early Judaism and Zoroastrianism in West Asia. And the Western philosophical tradition in the Northern Mediterranean. You know, I mean, think about that for a minute. That, you know, the scope of that in a relatively short period of time. You've got, you know, think of the names involved, Confucius, the Buddha, Plato, Socrates, on and on. I just, pretty amazing what was going on. The philosopher Karl Jaspers termed that the Axial Age because it was so pivotal for what humanity has become. So he termed it the Axial Age, pivoting. Certainly, enormous cultural diversity. No one's saying that it was all the same thing. Enormous cultural diversity. And yet, within such diversity, there's remarkable similarities. Remarkable similarities. And the one I want to focus on for the moment is that all of those traditions held that the answers to those big questions that human beings ask aren't found outside. That they're found by turning within, by contemplating the workings of our mind and being. And the human being developed the ability to do that during that time frame. An important point that goes right along with that is that practicing religion or philosophy wasn't a dry, abstract intellectual assent to abstract notional beliefs. Okay? Religion and philosophy was meant to be a rigorous practice, a way of life, a way of being that if one fully engaged in it, it had the power to awaken us to what the deepest truths of what we are, of who and what we are. But that only happens through engaging in the practice. So all forms of religious practices developed, different forms of ritual and worship, prayer, and all kinds of things developed. But common through all of them is this idea that you can't step back intellectually and analyze it and have it make sense. It's only by engaging in it that one can awaken to the truths that it's pointing to. And to do that, when one does that and awakens, it transforms the way they live. So an entire way of living and being and conducting oneself. That's what religion, philosophy was intended to be. To fully participate in this, to embody the ultimate mystery that we are. Our intellect alone can't do that. All those traditions held that in common. Let me give a personal example of that, of intellect alone not being able to do it. When I was in college, some of those big questions had grabbed me. I was just taken with the idea that how can we possibly live right if we aren't clear about what we are, about ultimate things? For me, it was, you know, how can we begin to know how to live if we aren't clear about what is God? What's our relationship to God? How can we do that? So those questions really, really grabbed me. When I was in college, I was really grabbed by that. So what do you think I did?
Read books.
Read books, yep. Where do you read the most books you're ever going to read?
Graduate school.
Graduate school, exactly. Like so many in our culture, if you want to understand something, you go to graduate school and you study it and you read all kinds of books and you have incredible dialogues about, what do you think of Karl Rahner's sense of the supernatural existential, and you know, how does that relate to what Bart has to say, and you know, these intense conversations. Very, very, very interesting, heady stuff. So I did indeed, went off to Yale Divinity School to study, to try to figure it out. And my focus of studies was in systematic theology. And I was pretty good at it. And by my third year there, I had enough integrity, I think, to recognize that I had become pretty skilled at playing a certain kind, fairly sophisticated Christian language game. But the integrity was recognizing that I had learned how to play other language games too. And if you're trying to explain reality, a language game or a worldview is one because it feels like it explains it all. So I was becoming adept at playing a particular Christian language game, but I also had, because I had interest in science and whatnot, I'd studied forestry as an undergrad. And so was fairly adept at playing other language games too. Yeah. You can play a secular humanist language game. You can play a materialist language. There's all kinds of language games that can be played to try to answer those big questions and account for things. And so the question becomes, how do you know really which one is real? What do those words even mean? And I became really stuck, really, really stuck, and got into a very, very kind of dark night period. Didn't quite know what to do. Most of the professors and whatnot that I turned to for guidance, wonderful people, good people, but most of them, that was their business. Their thought was, you know, you've been at it nonstop for quite a while. Why don't you take a semester off, take it easy, you'll be fine. Yeah. Earlier I mentioned my friend Peter McCarthy, the Trappist monk that I had met my third year. He comes back into the story here. You know, talking with Peter about the dark night that I was in. And he got it instantly. Instantly. Just, he was like, of course. Of course. of course that's where you're at. He said, you know? Your intellect has taken you as far as it can take you. Your intellect, you're not going to figure out what you're trying to figure out. You can't do it. But you can realize it. You can attain it. In fact, you're already it. You just don't know it. And he asked me, so what's your practice? What's your spiritual practice? And I said, what's spiritual practice? Because academic theology is quite a head trip. And so he taught me. Which brings us sort of back again to the kind of common ground. All of those religions and philosophies that stemmed from the Axial Age, directly or indirectly. So Christianity stems from that in the sense of growing out of Judaism. All of those traditions not only begin with asking those big questions, but all of them developed contemplative practices as a means for folks to realize who and what they are. All of them. And the similarities between those that we're going to talk more of in a bit, but incredible similarities between those, that who and what we are, ultimate reality, whatever words you want to put, give it. It can be realized, but it can't be conceptually understood. Okay? As the Greek, the author Nikos Katsenzakis written, life is not a problem to be solved. It's a mystery to be lived. Okay? So we'll look at some of those practices more in just a bit. So another common ground that developed in Christianity, it was referred to as negative theology, via negativa. In Buddhism, they speak of emptiness. Whatever name you want to give it, you know, whatever name you want to talk about what it is, God, Buddha, energy, whatever you want to call it, it transcends all of our concepts, our categories, our notions. Anything that we think about it, it's not that. And it's not that, you know? So that the negative theology develops, all these traditions develop this negative approach of what it is can't be conceptualized. Every idea that we have is inadequate. It's based on our human experience of beings, but that what the truth is entirely in its out of that realm. And so our words fail us. All of them have to be negated. And then you have to negate the negation because that's wrong too, or inadequate too. So not this, not this. What is it? So what we are is beyond every assertion or denial that we can make. Now, human beings use language. It's a pretty amazing tool that evolves, capacity that evolved in human beings. And so no one was saying one should never talk. But what they were saying was that recognize the total inadequacy of the conceptualizing that you're doing. Use it skillfully, but don't be enslaved by it. That's much, much harder to do than we imagine. We most of the time get enslaved by it. So all of these traditions, common to all the contemplative traditions, the negative theology or negative approach, kind of right along with that is this sense of the importance of embracing a silence. This mind before thinking, what is that? You know, Zen Master Sung San used to teach, Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. But if you're not thinking, then what? Right. So this before thinking, what is that? And so in these traditions, what's called apophatic forms of prayer, meditation developed, forms that don't rationally engage with words or concepts or images. They may use them, words or concepts or images, but they're not rationally engaging with them. They're not discursively thinking about them. They're maybe using those skillfully and using silence skillfully. So the apophatic forms became very common in all of these traditions, not to the exclusion of cataphatic forms, but very, very common and well used. There's countless examples of that. I'll just use a couple quickly here. In the Christian tradition, in the late 5th, early 6th century, the sort of enigmatic figure, Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, not a common household word, right? One of his teachings, into this dark, beyond all light, we pray to come, and unseeing and unknowing, to see and to know that which is beyond seeing, beyond knowing, precisely by not seeing, by not knowing. Pseudo-Dionysius is recognized now as just such an important luminary in the Christian spiritual tradition. Incredibly important in that tradition. What is that? How do we see by not seeing, by not knowing? What is that? From our Zen Master Sung San tradition, kind of a more recent, but I think the same teaching point here. Zen Master Sung San taught that I don't teach enlightenment. I don't teach Zen. I teach don't know. Okay? Only don't know. Socrates would run around Athens. People would asking, figuring out who are we. You know, who are you, Socrates? I don't know. But I understand that not knowing. Okay. So this don't know, thinking back to the graduate school, in our culture, we want to know, rationally understanding everything is given the premium. I'm not denigrating rational understanding. It has its place. But knowing its limits is important. And so in our culture, we want to understand everything. And when we are trying to sort out these big questions. You know, what am I? What is our purpose of being here? These big questions. And it's not immediately obvious to us. For most, that's, I don't know. A panic sets in. And you either run off to graduate school, or one way or another, you're trying to know, to get free of that sense of panic. The Zen teaching, and in other contemplative traditions as well, that don't know is an invitation not to panic, but to settle into what is this? Don't know. Don't know. To stay with that, to rest in the not knowing, and to see what happens. So one final, more abstract here before we look at some concrete practices. Another common ground is the response that contemplative awakening evokes. For those who awaken to their sense of who and what we are, when people awaken to that, it moves them to respond in each moment. In Buddhism, that's spoken of as compassion, to respond with compassion. See the suffering and respond with compassion. In Christianity, it's spoken of as agape, love. But those who wake up to what we are respond. You can't be just indifferent. You wake up to the truth of what we are, the intimacy. What are we? You and me, are we separate and different? Intimacy. And there's a saying, you know, that when it's intimacy like that, then the mouth speaks out when the foot is stepped on. Okay? When we become intimate with reality like that, we can see clearly how this limited I, my, me mentality prevents us from awakening to what we really are, and prevents us from responding spontaneously with love, with compassion. In Christianity, that's spoken of as sin in the sense of alienation. Alienation from what we are, from God. Okay. In Buddhism, they speak of it as the, you know, delusion or something, the three poisons of greed, anger, and ignorance. You know, the spinning on ourself. In Christianity, I think in the gospel where John the Baptizer is saying, I must decrease, he must increase. Okay. Who is that he's pointing to? Okay, so enough kind of broad brushstrokes. Let's look more concretely, kind of concrete practices, common ground. What was the very title? Christian and Buddhist Contemplative Practices for Compassionate Living. Okay. Some concrete practices. First one, silence. Skillful use of silence. Sometimes at the start of our retreats, teacher might say something like, if the only thing you do on this retreat is keep silence, you already will have helped yourself and everyone else. Okay? All these traditions recognize the power, the importance of silence. And when we really realize that, then how does speaking become silence? And silence becomes speaking. Don't make opposites, no problem. But the skillful use of silence. Another, probably the most commonly thought of common ground form, meditation. It's one most folks would more immediately think of. And a quick interruption of that, just to sort of note some interesting terminology. In the Christian West, there was the term recollection. Now, recollection is like recollecting our scattered consciousness. In some traditions, they'll speak of that as monkey mind. You know, our mind that is here, there, everywhere, but right here. Right? Recollection in Christian tradition meant a gathering in of our faculties. And they spoke of oratio, meditatio, contemplatio, you know, oral prayer. So already there's more focus given through oral prayer, scattered consciousness, gathered, sort of funneling in. Meditatio, meditation. And this is why I note this, because in the at one point in time in the Christian tradition, the word meditation meant more of a very focused rumination, a focused thinking on a narrow topic. You know, one might meditate on the sufferings of Jesus in the garden, or one might meditate on the resurrection. It was using conceptual imagery and thought, but using that as the point of attention and focus. And when I become aware that I'm thinking about the argument I had with my boss, not on the meditation of Jesus in the garden that I was setting out to meditate on, I return to that. Okay? So meditatio is that. And then the word contemplatio, contemplation, more akin to the way we now use the word meditation. You know, focused on practice form, and I'm speaking mostly here apophatic forms, so contemplatio, contemplation, more the word in the ancient Christian tradition to what we call meditation. So I'll just use the word meditation here for ease. So with meditation, we can think of formal meditation, you know, and kind of moment-to-moment contemplative practices. So it's contemplative practices in a more narrow sense. For most people, we're not very good at simply paying attention to right here, right now. We're not very good at it. And so all these traditions developed formal meditation practices for us to practice paying attention to just this moment, right now. So that's meditation in its more narrow sense. And we'll come back to that in just a moment. But meditation in the broader sense is moment to moment to moment to moment. What are you doing right now? Wake up. Do it. When you're driving your car, drive your car. And when you become aware that you're imagining a good meal in San Francisco, you're really driving downtown in Wheaton, return to what you're doing. What am I doing right now? So we can have contemplative practices to develop the skill, but the point is contemplative living. To be this way, to live this life of moment to moment to moment. Wake up. Contemplative living is what it's about. Getting good at sitting on a cushion silently in a room, getting proficient at sitting on a cushion, I'll teach students, kind of a waste of life if that doesn't pay off in moment to moment to moment. Wake up, see it clearly, and respond with compassion. So the formal meditation forms that developed in our school, we use sitting meditation, walking meditation, bowing meditation, and chanting meditation. Those are the formal practices. All, as I just say, all of them designed to become proficient at moment to moment to moment. Sitting meditation, and often we'll use the word practice for that. And my guess is I'm preaching to the choir here, so it's kind of different meditation forms, countless different meditation forms, in the sense of the practice form that when I become aware that I'm not doing right here what I'm doing, if we're sitting in meditation, practice forms developed to give somewhat of an anchor, something for the person to return back to. And commonly used would be using a word. Well, it could be any word. And whether it's the word God or Jesus or don't know, having a word that when I become aware that I am not just sitting here in meditation, I bring my attention back to that word. I'm not thinking about it, analyzing it. It's not a discursive, rational process. It's just a skillful tool to return back, gives me something to come back to. So that's a very common meditation practice in all these traditions. Other practices involve the breath, you know, the importance that all of these traditions recognize this, the connection between our body, our mind, our practice, all of it, we've woven together. And so using the breath is common in many, many of the traditions, whether it's breath counting or just an awareness of the sensations of the breathing, all kinds of different practices using the breath. It's a nice practice. You got it with you everywhere. Can't go anywhere without it. So you can use your breath all the time. So all kinds of different meditation practices. Just sitting. Difficult for folks early on, but as people become more proficient at it, simply sitting, aware that one is sitting there. Just sitting. And when I become aware that I am off in space somewhere, I just come back to just sitting. So lots of different sitting meditation practices develop, but extremely common through all these traditions. Different postures that were used, kneeling, sitting on cushions, cross-legged on the floor, standing, lying down, if necessary. So there's remarkable similarities in the different postures used in these practices in different traditions, but also an importance of recognizing that not being attached to the posture. If someone can't sit in a cross-legged position, doesn't mean they can't meditate. You know, sit in a chair, stand up. You know, we've had folks with back injuries attend our retreats and they lie down through the entire retreat. No problem. You know, what's your mind doing, really? So there's a both and here. All these traditions over thousands of years have recognized that if one can, there's some skillful means going on with some of the postures that developed. To willy-nilly just say, none of that's important, would be kind of irresponsible or not recognizing wisdom. But on the other hand, of getting attached to it and thinking, it has to be like this and only this, is a big problem. Chanting is a common practice in Christian and Buddhism. When I was a monk in the Trappist Abbey, chanting the Psalms. You know, seven times a day, the monks would gather together and chant from the Psalms and canticles of scripture. In Buddhism, using sutras in other traditions, that's a common thing. Makes sense. The human experience of our voice, the vibrations involved with that, makes sense that that developed as a common practice form in these ways. And in all of them, the recognition that when we're chanting as spiritual practice, our intention isn't to be concerned with making beautiful music. Sometimes our chanting for an outsider walking in sounds pretty awful, but that's not the point. Okay? It's a together practice of chanting together. So that's a common form. Using the physical body, all kinds of different, attention to postures. In our school, we do prostrations in the morning, 108 prostrations, full body bows. In some Christian traditions, some holding different forms. Some would stand in sort of a cruciform shape position. So, this awareness of the connection between the body, the mind, the role of the body in spiritual practice. And so all kinds of forms develop related to that, and attention to the energy levels. It's involving our whole being is the point. Related with the positioning of the hands. How do you hold your hands when in prayer or in meditation? My gut feeling is part of that. A lot of forms and rituals develop out of very practical things at the start. Human beings are incredibly self-conscious, and our hands can really be a measure of that. So finding a posture where you can kind of just hold your hands and forget about it, not be self-conscious, is, I think, part of that as well. Walking meditation is a common form in many of the traditions. Breathing. The use of mantras. Repeating phrases over and over again in the Christian tradition, the repetition of the phrase, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Praying the rosary. The rosary can be prayed as a meditation form in the traditional Christian usage of that word. One might be thinking about the glorious mysteries as they're praying the rosary. But it can be used as a contemplative prayer form when one's not imaginatively thinking about anything. One's just becoming the words, just repeating over and over and over and over again. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Along with that, the use of malas, rosary beads. In Buddhist tradition, we call them malas. But most of the traditions developed strings of beads to a skillful means. We do 108 bows in the morning. You know, that's a lot. So you don't want to do 120. So you're counting on a string of beads is a help. But more important than that, the sense, the physical tactile sensation. Again, this bringing together our body, our breath, our mind. The tactile sense, for many people, the tactile sensation of moving the beads helps them return to the practice. Just do it. Okay. The importance of teachers, spiritual directors, kind of a recognition that exploring this realm, there can be a lot of potential pitfalls or getting off track, and having guidance from someone who can skillfully lead the way can be very important. And all these traditions, this development of the roles of teachers or gurus or spiritual directors. The transformation of time. Structuring the day in ways that continually remind and give opportunities for practice. Structuring the year, feast days, celebration days, commemoration, you know, this sort of transformation of time to make it serve the purpose. Yeah. All the traditions did that. Communal living and or practice. This the importance for most folks, maintaining contemplative practices solo is very difficult. Some folks seem to have a kind of a hermit calling, but for most folks, maintaining these practices solo is difficult. And the importance that all these traditions found of doing this together, practicing together, supporting each other. Sometimes that's expressed in living together, communal living. Other times, folks coming together for set practice periods, worship, celebration. Earlier, we spoke about how awakening leads to the overflowing of compassion. Using compassionate acts, works of mercy, as a skillful means of helping in to control that I, my, me mind. Okay. So compassionate acts seem to become a common ground. And the importance of work practice. Most of these traditions, a recognition of working together for our livelihood, our sustenance is important. It's not just accidental. It's not a bad thing that wish we were independently wealthy so that we could just devote all our time to prayer. This sense that work is prayer. More than one tradition had developed the saying, you know, a day without work is a day without eating. The importance of that. And one last one, tongue-in-cheek, when Craig and I were driving, he was kind enough to pick me up at the airport today, and we were driving back here, and we got talking about some of this. And another common ground, a little tongue-in-cheek, but not entirely, is that the percentage of folks in any tradition that will even try contemplative practices seems to be pretty small. And the percent of those that'll stay with it a month later is smaller still. And 6 months later and a year later, I think, you know, these practices demand of us. They're not just a passive sit and get edified by nice words. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. But there's more. Making it our own. And these contemplative practices, that's what they're about, is doing it. Making one's entire life do it. I'm sure there's others. That's enough of my talking here. Let's open it to questions. Let me just close with one of the most frequent teachings of our founding teacher, Zen Master Sung Song, which kind of summarizes everything I've said. His favorite teaching was, only go straight, don't know. Try, 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 for 10,000 years nonstop. Attain enlightenment, save all beings from suffering. Thank you very much.
I thought the Buddha taught to not look to a leader, to not have someone guiding you, that only you yourself can discover these truths.
Absolutely. That's correct. But he didn't mean that you can't recognize and be benefited from assistance from others.
You talked about a lot of similarities and parallels between the two major traditions that you were talking about. Do you feel that an individual can benefit from blending those traditions, or, as I think some people argue, it's important to pick a path and go really deep on the path rather than trying to blend them, even though they may be using different vocabularies to talk about the same thing sometimes.
Yeah. So what were you doing right then?
Asking a question.
Correct. Correct. So when someone's praying, in the contemplative spirit, you know, if one's praying, just pray 100%. Asking a question, ask a question 100%. Okay. Sitting in meditation. So when you're doing it, just do it.
I have a question from someone through the internet. How could one's view of death and the afterlife either mitigate or be enhanced, either be mitigated or enhanced by using these contemplative practices?
So that raises a big question, doesn't it? You know, we have a word, life. We have the word, death. We think we know what we're talking about, but do we really? So these practices may help us with that. Looking more deeply into what is life, what is death? Who is it that lives? Who is it that dies? These practices can help us with that. In the Heart Sutra in Buddhism, it's interesting because one of the lines it talks about is no old age and death, and no cessation of old age and death. Negation. And negate the negation.
I'm really drawn to the fourfold path, and you've talked about the via negativa. And I'm curious, in Buddhism, what focus there is on the via positiva? Are there practices for that?
Again, Buddhism is broad umbrella. And my familiarity is more with Zen. Zen tends to be more of an apophatic approach. So I can't speak as knowledgeably about Buddhism as a whole. I think the answer to that is yes. I think there are traditions that do more with that. But my familiarity is with Zen, and I should speak more from what I know.
When we talk about contemplative meditation, when we sit in meditation and say in silence, then the mind comes in a back door and tries to analyze and what is contemplation, what is silence. So that's the kind of, we are drawn into the mind, out of the mind. Mind can play a lot of tricks when we are silent because we're not used to the silence. So so we feel awkward the minute we are into silence because we are so used to talking. So this contemplative term is a little bit, I'm not very clear. I don't know exactly what it means. Is it more to do with the mind or not to do with the mind at all? Thank you.
Sure. It was interesting today, flying here. I don't fly very often. I don't travel a lot. And so it was kind of interesting to be flying and being above the clouds, and especially getting closer here, there was a lot of cloud cover, but it was above the clouds. We were above the clouds. And so the blue sky was I was really sensing. And a teaching in our school often said, that's the things I used to teach about how, you know, blue sky is always blue sky. Clouds come, clouds go, no problem. Blue sky is always there. So our brain's job is to produce thoughts. And depending on all kinds of variables, you know, how much we've eaten, how much sleep we've gotten, how much thinking we've been doing, countless things influence that sort of biochemical, electrical thought generator. No problem. You know, thoughts come, thoughts go, sometimes lots of them, sometimes none of them. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. One of the most frequent pitfalls that people new to meditation fall into, frequently say to us, is they try it and they say, you know, this isn't for me. Clearly, I am not right for this because I tried to sit quietly, I tried to empty my mind of thoughts, and I just couldn't do it. And, you know, I just say, well, welcome to the club. No one can. And the good news is we don't have to. You know, our job is to simply, when we become aware that we're not doing what we're doing, to return back to it. Are we willing to do that even if we have to haul our mind back every nanosecond? You know? Meditation is about the willingness to come back to this moment. What am I doing right now and do it? Am I willing to keep coming back? Sometimes I have to come back every nanosecond, and other times feels like bliss. I'm just, you know, coasting along doing it. So the thoughts appearing, disappearing, no problem. You know, when we become aware that we're caught up in them, then come back to, what am I doing right now? When we're doing a formal meditation practice, then what am I doing right now is sitting still and returning to whatever my practice is, whether it's, you know, saying the name Jesus or breath counting or what's my practice? That's what I'm doing, should be doing right now. If I'm chopping vegetables, then come back to chopping vegetables.
Okay? Thank you, thank you. In our society, we're encouraged and praised for multitasking. And, you know, with the technology today, it's just the total opposite of what your our contemplative practices are aiming for. Ways to practically apply and counteract all these, the technological influences and disturbances in our lives so that we can be a little more contemplative?
Sure. It's interesting. Science is coming to the assistance here as well. It's increasingly been proven, I think, conclusively, but multitasking doesn't work. Multitasking doesn't work. If we're trying to do simultaneously things that are drawing on the same brain centers, then it's counterproductive. And that's becoming increasingly recognized. Zen Master Sung San used to have his teaching about we have to be like an elevator. The elevator, on all the different floors, people are pressing the button. Pressing the button. First floor, 100th floor, 37th floor, 24th floor. But the elevator knows its job. It just goes. If it's responding to up, it goes up. First floor, second floor, third floor, fourth floor. And it goes down. Okay? It knows its direction, knows its job. So for each of us, at any moment, what am I doing right now? So that's one thought. Second one is sometimes we can get attached to the formulation, what am I doing right now? Like that we can only ever do one thing at a time. That too, that description is just using words a certain way to teach. But if you look at it, that's not really true. When you're driving your car, there's a lot going on. All kinds of senses are activated. All kinds of things going on that you have to be aware of. So our being can track a lot of things. But what am I doing right now? Do that. If I'm driving my car, I really probably shouldn't be trying to be solving some math problem in my head. So one time students walked in and Zen Master Sung San, he was eating his breakfast reading a newspaper. And they challenged him, it was like, Zen Master, you always teach us, just, whatever you're doing, just do it. And here, look at you, you're reading the newspaper, eating breakfast. He goes, yeah. And when I'm eating the newspaper, when I'm reading the newspaper and eating my breakfast, I'm reading the newspaper and eating my breakfast. So I think that our recognizing that most of us, I know I do, have difficulty paying attention to one thing at a time and the importance of developing that skill. Living our life means, as I, here with you, I'm paying attention to a lot that's going on.